Hello, and welcome to USSOcast. It's been some time since our last episodes, and in that time, there's been some shuffling of the editorial chairs. So, our original fantastic host, Sarah Collier, has moved on to different and great things. I'm Sam Thoser, co-communications and outreach editor here at US Studies Online, and I'll be doing my best to take up the mantle from Sarah as host. In this podcast, we aim to highlight the work of British-based PhD students and early career researchers in American studies. I'm delighted to say that today, for our first interview of the new series, I'll be speaking to Jess Underwood, a PhD candidate from the University of Warwick, who researches American political economy. Jess's work as a researcher concentrates on American attitudes toward the economy and how they relate to protest movements. She has been interviewing those who participated in protests during the period of the first COVID-19 lockdowns in 2020 to find out how they view the economy, or indeed what the economy really means when people invoke it. Jess has previously written about the Tea Party movement and its creative approach to revolutionary era history. Jess has also recently benefited from a Research Assistance Award provided by the British Association for American Studies, which allowed her to carry out some of those interviews in person on a trip to the US last year. So, Jess, welcome to USSOcast. It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you for being on.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Sam.
So, to start, can I ask what first drew you to this subject? Did it grow out of previous work, or where did it come from?
Yeah, so I as you mentioned, I wrote it during my master's about the Tea Party movement. And I did my master's back in 2009. So this was right at the height of the Tea Party movement. And then I took about 10 years out and went to work in corporate conferences, completely separate from academia. And then after 10 years out, I decided I wanted to come back, and I wrote up my PhD proposal in 2019. The Tea Party movement, what's so fascinating to me is that you just have these everyday Americans who are dressing up in colonial outfits, right? And then they go out into the world and they're demanding cuts for deficit spending. And I just think that is absolutely wild. I just think it's really fascinating the way that this comes out. And so I had written this, a decade earlier, right? And then COVID happened. And I was just like everybody else. And then I was locked at home. I was in my house. I was still working in conferences, but you can imagine that most conferences got canceled. And so I was, in lockdown, and I thought, well, I'm a little out of practice of academia, so I'll try to go back and like update my Tea Party paper. And I thought, oh, I'll just go back and do this. And that was sort of, I decided to do this around March of 2020. And my supervisor, even though I wasn't in my PhD yet, my supervisor was very supportive. I'm like, yeah, go ahead. I'll. And then as I'm going through and re-researching the Tea Party, and this is in 2020, these anti-lockdown movements. The protests start happening, and my supervisor sends me through news articles saying, "Hey, did you know that these are linked to the Tea Party movement?" I was like, "Shh, Matt, I'm focused on the Tea Party movement. Don't pester me." And so yeah, I think looking into that and realizing that a lot of these stay at home, these protests against the stay at home orders were connected to the Tea Party really drew me back into it. And then I really want to credit the Black and Brown and Indigenous activists who really came out. 6 weeks later, we get the George Floyd protests. And I think even I, as a white American, sort of felt like, oh, well, these things are disconnected. And I think that one of the things that the Black Lives Matter protests did really well during that summer is to really communicate the relationship between the COVID-19, the death of George Floyd, and America's history with white supremacy. So that's how I ended up here.
Fantastic. Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, you took a research trip to the US last year. Could you tell us a little bit more about that fieldwork?
Yeah, so again, as a political economist, I am really interested in economic ideas specifically. So I mentioned deficit spending. I've looked at capitalism and markets before, but for my PhD research, I really wanted to look at the concept of the economy. And so from my perspective, I wanted to, it's a very important term. All the polls, it's always, that we've heard that trite term, the economy's stupid, right? obviously that gives a lot of meaning to people in terms of acting politically. And so I definitely wanted to look at that specifically. And then when you get COVID-19, you get the reopen the economy protests, right? And that's what they were called. And you get this framing of like, oh, we have to make a decision. Do we want to protect the economy? Or do we, you know, do we want to have these very strict lockdown orders? And then 6 weeks later, of course, we get the George Floyd protests after George Floyd was lynched. And, you know, and I thought this is the context that is going to help me study the economy in a way that sort of gives it a little bit of something for people to hold on to. And what I did first off is I actually spent time doing desk research. So a combination of looking at social media posts during April to June of 2020 from both groups, right? And I ended up focusing on two different geographies. So the first one being Lansing, Michigan, because that's where Operation Gridlock took place. And Operation Gridlock was not the very first anti-lockdown protest, but it was certainly the largest and the most like internationally recognized. So I think they estimate somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 people participated in that specific protest. And then I also focused on Minneapolis, which of course is where George Floyd was murdered. And I had this amazing social media data, all of these, you know, like documents that had been shared and, you know, mission statements and things like that. But I really believe in this idea from ethnography, and it's something that's shared amongst different kinds of ethnographers, this belief that if you want to know what somebody believes, you should ask them. And I really wanted the opportunity to actually speak with people and to allow them to explain to me what the economy means to them in their own words. So I was hugely grateful to Bass, and also I also got support from the APG to be able to fund this fieldwork to go there, because it was in it was really in my time in these two cities that I got these really amazing answers. And I have a couple examples, Sam. I don't know if you want to listen to a couple of those.
Yes, I'd love to.
Okay, so first off, this comes from Samuel. All of these are pseudonymized. They you know, their identities are protected.
And I think the government was playing sophisticated games. So what do I mean by that? They closed down all the little shops, the mom and pop stores. Mm-hmm. They couldn't open for business. So what did that mean? You had to go online, Amazon. They made Amazon into Amazon. They were evolving anyway, but they forced its evolution. And so you only could do business with a few big guys.
Yeah.
And the same thing went with banks, et cetera, over various economic crises, not necessarily with COVID per se, but so you put the powers of the economy into silos, major big silos, and you destroy the free market.
Mm.
And that's what COVID did.
Yeah.
Intentionally, one could debate. I think it was intentional. One could say maybe it just happened, but they basically put the big companies were the winners.
Yeah.
And the little guys were the losers. There's no doubt about that. Which just gives government more control over society.
And so you can see there, you know, Samuel, and this was something that was very consistent across the reopen group, is framing, of course, the economy as separate from the government, and the government in, you know, infringing on the economy. That was a very important thing that they understood about COVID. But I just want to contrast that with Ashley, who was one of my Black Lives Matter supporters.
Like, it's not like everyone's like, the economy is like, I care more about people than I care about how the economy goes, because the economy will always grow or change and be fine on its own as long as they're anything. Like, it shouldn't take priority over like the needs of the people. We shouldn't be like, well, the economy is doing all right, so, but I'm like, people are literally dying. Like during the COVID crisis, I'm like, they're like, the economy's failing. It's like, people are literally dying. That's why. It's like, no one's working anymore because they all died. Because they all died. People literally died.
And so you get this entirely different understanding of the economy, right? For one, she sees it as something that's sort of difficult to, you know, to combat against, right? And that kind of creates this tension between real people and their lives, right? And the economy. And these are things that I could potentially have inferred from my social media research, but it's just entirely different when you're sat down in front of somebody and you're having a real conversation with them.
listening to you talk and to your interviewees there as well, it put me back in the moment of COVID so vividly and lockdown, because during the first COVID lockdown, the period your research covers, I was living in a place called Clearfield, Pennsylvania, which is a town of 6,000 people in central Pennsylvania, very, very heavily Republican. And this is the newspaper from May 21st, 2020. And obviously this won't come across in the audio, but you can see it. It says do or die. And this is a picture of a local cafe owner saying that they're going to reopen the dining room against lockdown orders, so that the local economy can, I don't know, remain intact. And
Well, and that's it, is that I think that's a really good example, because I definitely see this theme of like the economy is life or death, right? And it's interpreted in different ways, because to some extent you can see Ashley is framing the economy as a kind of death, right? That this object is being promoted and people are dying. And then on the opposite side, you get this sense that like if we close down the economy, life as we know it is never going to return to normal. And I think it is interesting, because we all lived through the pandemic. It went on for so long, and I think there's like a desperation to like not talk about it anymore. But it taught us a lot about who we are and what our priorities are in society.
absolutely. And well, to take this interview in a slightly more self-indulgent direction, all of my research is also about the Midwest, just by chance. So I wanted to talk to you about the Midwest just briefly. So you've been conducting interviews with Midwesterners in Michigan, in Minnesota. We've seen many protests and movements spring up in the Midwest over the past decade. You talked about Operation Gridlock. But there are others too. I mean, both in cities and in suburbs, covering a broad spectrum of political perspectives. So Black Lives Matter, had its origins in Ferguson, Missouri, and the death of, or the murder of Michael Brown in 2014. More recent protests in Minneapolis. And then on the other hand, you talk about Operation Gridlock in Lansing. There was also the plot to kidnap and possibly murder Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, in 2020, which I believe the perpetrators were recently sentenced. And that was apparently an extremist right-wing response to COVID lockdowns in the state. So do you think there's anything particular to the Midwest and its culture, the culture of its people, that makes it especially fertile ground for such movements?
It's such a good question, Sam. Like, it doesn't surprise me that you're researching this at all, because it like the moment that you start to ask it, my brain just starts, thinking. And I mean, what I will say is that I'm from the Midwest, so you can hear in my accent. I live here now. I'm now a British citizen. I had to take the test and everything. I've been living here for about 15 years, but I grew up in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma is a sort of strange category. We're kind of almost the border between the Midwest and the South, right? And the Midwest, it's not just the middle geographically. It's kind of the middle historically as well. And especially whenever you're thinking in terms of American colonial domination. And so I think Midwesterners can sometimes, because they see themselves as the middle historically, right? They feel sort of disconnected from some of the quote unquote earlier mistakes of American history. And so, there's the history of American slavery, but that was like Georgia and South Carolina, we weren't really doing that because we were in the middle, right? And it's interesting because, of course, Missouri played a very important role in terms of the history of slavery. I certainly grew up in Oklahoma, having never learned about the Tulsa race riots. In fact, I even just made the slip there. I eventually was told about the race massacre, let's be clear. But when I was first told about it, I was told, oh, well, this is just a sort of dispute between white and black communities. I wasn't told that Tulsans massacred hundreds of Black Americans and raised their communities, burning down businesses, houses,
And supposedly it was the Black Wall Street, right?
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, you know, trying to pull apart the economic dimension from the racial dimension here is very difficult, right? Because obviously what you get is a lot of antagonism between these two racial communities over the fact that these Black communities were doing so well economically. And you know, and that's it, is that, you know, the Midwest, and going back to Minneapolis, and let's, you know, talk about Minneapolis here, it's often referred to as the Jim Crow of the North. And part of the reason why is they had these real estate covenants where you get these white communities that are pledging to make sure that these communities stay white. And again, this is all about ensuring that that wealth, that the land, that, in, you know, land is such an important factor of production in the study of economics, that remains in the control of people who are white. And, you know, and so, yeah, you can think back, whether you go all the way back, you know, looking back to the, you know, 17th and 18th century, my family, we were involved in the war over Texas, and also in the slaughtering of Comanches in order to put Texas under the control of the United States. All of this is a part of that sort of Midwestern history. And I actually lived in Oklahoma City at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing. Right. And I do think that the Midwest sort of positions itself as, you know, like the heroes in this American mythology. And this creates this this environment for and what I will say is that many of my friends and family in Oklahoma still believe to this day that this was actually led by a power from the Middle East. They believe it was like Iraq or Iran. And I think there's just this denial that actually the biggest perpetrators of violence in the Midwest in recent history are white Americans.
And you're talking there about Timothy McVeigh.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And this is it, is Timothy McVeigh. You know, again, you know, I remember being there when all of the rumors were going around that there was an Arab or a Muslim man who had been seen, and that this was the real person. It couldn't possibly be this 18-year-old former military person. He must have been supported by somebody else. He must have been pushed by somebody else, instead of understanding that actually the sort of culture around, you know, American myths makes it sound like you need some sort of white savior to come in to keep the country from being turned over to people who are not white.
And perhaps a mythology that's only grown more popular and more widespread in recent years. So you're talking about extremists. I mean, I understand, you know, depending on who you're interviewing, you know, you may be sympathetic to the views of many of your interviewees, but there are others that you must have found more difficult to deal with. Have you had any trouble maintaining objectivity as an interviewer? I know you're talking about an ethnographic approach, but you're still a person.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very challenging. And I have a few examples of that. I mean, first off, I think it's probably not a surprise listening to this interview that I am certainly more ideologically aligned with the Black Lives Matter movement. And you know, I wanted to go into this community and not present myself as a friend or as, you know, and I wanted to be honest about what my research was, but then also to try to maintain some sort of objectivity, because I don't want my ideas influencing the research. And I will say that arriving at George Floyd Square, a remarkable place, they're still holding meetings there twice a day, every day. And I, you know, this is where I recruited a lot of the people that I interviewed. And when I got there, you know, I'm a white woman coming into this activist space saying I'm a researcher. I mean, they didn't know me at all. And it might have been nice for me to have performed that sort of agreement with them, you know, to try to encourage them to participate in an interview. But I understood that, like, it's really important that I not influence this in any way. And unfortunately, you know, I was able to secure all the interviews. On the flip side, I grew up in Oklahoma, as I mentioned. I grew up an evangelical conservative. And so I'm very familiar with the ideologies of the reopen movement. Many of the people I interviewed remind me of family and friends from Oklahoma who I love, right? And so, you know, one of the things I really felt was a need to portray these communities and these people in a way that I think is respectful. And I wanted to take their ideas seriously. And I mean, you can, you know, look at the sort of statement from Samuel there. I think that there's a lot to be said about, you know, this concern for the way in which it always seems like corporations get ahead. And that's not something that I disagree with at all. I completely agree with that. But I participated in, so they had this thing called Patriot Week. And Patriot Week is the week between September 11th and Constitution Day, which is September 17th. And this, I've heard some different stories about it, but it is supposed to have grown out of Michigan. And it is pure coincidence that I was there in Michigan at the time that this was happening. And I, when I asked someone who had been involved in the movement, you know, where would I go to find people like you? And they recommended Patriot Week. And it's supposed to be a nonpartisan sort of like event, but basically each day they have a panel and a citizen roundtable on a specific theme to renew the spirit of America. And the very, very first panel that I went to was on gender equality. And I'm sure you can imagine that that is a topic that is very personal to me. And it was very difficult listening to the panelists talking about, like, well, we've achieved gender equality, and I don't know what more is left to be done. And then it goes to the citizen discussion tables, like all of the people in the audience are supposed to talk to each other about the topic. And I, you know, explain that I'm a researcher, that I'm just here to observe. But I sat at this table predominantly composed of men, in which they said, you know, lots of very interesting interpretations of the topic, including that, you know, we need to understand the female psyche in terms of whether or not they should take on particular kinds of jobs. And I just had to sit, and it was very difficult. I definitely found it. But then the very next day, I went to the next topic, which was on racial equality. And again, the panelists talking about, you know, again, what's left to be achieved. We have equality of opportunity. And I was sat at a table with two Black women. And these Black women, you know, spoke of their own experiences of racism and saying, we haven't achieved anything. And similarly, I had to remain completely quiet. And it was a very challenging experience, not because I felt I needed to somehow be the rescuer, be the person that was involved, but it felt cowardly in that moment to not be a part of that conversation, to just be very quiet, even though I know all of the reasons why in my research I have to do that. It was still very, very difficult.
Well, I, for one, and I'm sure our listeners too, would be impressed by your restraint. What has surprised you most in your interviews with protesters, especially relating perhaps to their views on the economy?
Yeah, I mean, people think, like, oh, you're studying the economy, it's going to be very boring. You're going to have, you're going to be going there and it's going to be all about like trade and, you know, supply and demand and that sort of thing. And I will tell you, I mean, I'll play for you just like a little bit of this. This was, there was a vigil from somebody who had been killed by the police. And there was this Mexica Nahua, I think I'm pronouncing that accurately. It's an Aztec cultural group that performed. And you can hear a little bit of that. And so they're dancing, they have these I don't know how to call it, like shells or something that are around their ankles that are making that clicking sound. And it was really impressive and beautiful. And then, you know, a couple of days later, I'm finishing up an interview with one of my interviewees, and they turn around and then they're participating in the brass solidarity band. So, you know, I thought to myself, you know, I guess I'm doing economics research, but it did feel at points that I wasn't always doing that. But certainly, I think, and again, on the reopen side, I was really surprised the extent to which central banking played such an important factor in the way in which they understood the economy. Lots of discussions about the Alexander Hamilton's creation of the first central bank, Andrew Jackson's creation of the central bank. Very specific. They, one of my interviewees was like, "Oh, obviously on December 23rd of 1913." And I do this research. I don't know these dates. I'd never ever heard of that before. But by far, the biggest surprise was being mistaken for a federal agent. And I, so, again, I talked about the fact that, I'm entering into this, space at George Floyd Square as a white woman, and they were very suspicious of me. And they, as a part of the meeting, they were talking about the fact that they were suspicious that some of the police officers were coming into the square, trying to snoop on them, trying to find things about them, with the hope of trying to, to break down the whole thing. And in the middle of talking about this, one of the central organizers sort of waves at me and says, like, "Oh, you're probably a Fed." And I have to say, Sam, like, in all of the preparation that I did not think about like how I would have to potentially suggest that I'm not a federal agent. And like, the more that I thought about it, the more that I thought, like, well, I mean, if I were a federal agent, this would be very good. Like, I have a website ready to suggest that I still work for university. And I'm like, no, I really am just a political economy researcher. I don't know what to tell you. But then it came up again when I was in Michigan. And I had finished an interview with somebody who had participated in Operation Gridlock. And I was asking her, telling her at the end that, I had tried to set up these interviews in advance online and that I had just gotten nothing from anybody. And she's like, "Oh, well, that's probably because they thought you were a federal agent." And I was like, do I give off federal agent vibes? Like, is that how people see me? But in that case, it was, to some extent, even more, it made a little bit more sense because it turns out that the two principal organizers of Operation Gridlock, both Meeshaun Mattock and Marion Sheridan, have since been indicted for their role in the fake elector scheme in Michigan, and that several of the people who were involved in both Operation Gridlock and also Operation Haircut, those two major anti-lockdown protests, also participated in January 6th. And of course, there is a lot of them were saying, "Oh, we went to the rally, but we didn't actually go into the Capitol." But then it did make sense. And so you talk about, like, the Gretchen Whitmer, there are lots and lots of connections between these anti-lockdown protests and these other larger political events. And I'm just going in here because I'm interested in the anti-lockdown protests, but that didn't, move me away from the other things that were going on.
Well, I must say, compared to my own research trips, that sounds like a hell of an adventure. Finally, I just wanted to ask, is there any advice you'd give to another PhD student just beginning work in your field? Is there any advice you'd give to them?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think, the first thing I would say is that before I went on my trip, I had tried so hard. You have no idea. I had been emailing all of these people. I'd managed to secure one interview with someone from the Michigan Conservative Coalition before I went out there. And I had kind of hoped, again, like a snowballing effect, that I would get this one interview and then I would get more interviews. And the snowballing effect didn't happen. And so when I went, I didn't have anything lined up. And that seems mad. That seems like you should never, ever, ever do that. But I will say that there is magic to being in person. And that is certainly something that we learned after COVID-19, that actually going someplace and being in those communities and engaging with people face to face is an entirely different thing. And I ended up securing 16 interviews there when I was actually in those two places. And so what I would say is, if things aren't going well, it's okay. Like, just keep at it. And I would also say that when you get lots of no's, that's also okay. And just to just brush it off, move on to the next person, move on to the next thing, just keep at it because it will fall into place. It just does take time. And so I hope that people can hear me when I've said that I, you know, it didn't work out. I tried to do all this additional planning ahead of time, was trying to do all these different things and it just didn't happen, that things do work out. But then the second thing I would say is I would very, very strongly encourage you to build relationships with people who are in the sort of American studies community. And I think I was very fortunate that at work, I have a very good friend, Emma Hall, who has just completed her PhD, and she's very involved with BAS. And she had actually hoped to do some of this ethnographic research. She ended up doing a PhD under this amazing PhD on American textbooks and exceptionalism, which is fascinating. And I can't wait to read it. She's just finished her viva for that. And she was the one who sort of recommended, of course, lots of literature, but then also this particular award with BAS. And I didn't know about this at all. And it's only through building those relationships with other scholars that you figure out the literature that you need, that you figure out where to get the money, that you figure out the sort of people that you need to talk to. And so I think that's probably the thing that people underestimate the most is the value of being able to talk with other people. Yeah.
Fantastic advice. And I would echo it too. Thank you so much for your time today, Jess. It's been a pleasure talking to you and your work sounds fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much, Sam. It's been really, really fun.
Thanks again to my guest, Jess Underwood, for a really enlightening conversation and also for access and permission to use the clips that you've heard throughout. I hope you can join us next month.